Mr. Watkins, Real 8. Now, you were just taken in May when you'd had a VE day, and then you were sent up to Rosyth. What happened next?
Yeah, well, we called in Port of Inningham, the Humber, to take on fuel. And then we went up to Rosyth, and I think we actually went into the Rosyth dockyard and had a boiler clean at that stage. And after the boiler clean, we were told that we were being prepared and fitted out to go out to the Far East. So we ammunitioned ship and we went out in the North Sea, and we did more or less the same we've done on our working up trials. We were firing at target ships and having mock aircraft attacks with aircraft coming over and dropping sacks of flour on around the ship, and we did anti-submarine exercises as well. On a submarine out there, and we were taking pings off of that, the usual thing that you do, you know, training up, trying to get the ship back to full number one readiness. And we were doing that May, June, July, August. We must have been doing that for a month or two. And I don't know what happened to those months, but eventually we were within a week of setting sail for Japan when the A-bombs were dropped. And much to our relief, we're all looking forward to the experience of having suicide kamikaze pilots attacking us, and suddenly it was all washed away with the dropping of the A-bombs, and the commission finished virtually at Rosyth.
A big relief, then.
A big relief, indeed, yeah. And about 80% of the ship's company were sent back to barracks from Rosyth, back to Chatham and wherever they came from. Well, it was Chatham. And I was one of the crew that stayed on board as a scope and crew. And then we were told eventually that we'd take the ship back to America, as it was lease land. And that
would be in September, I suppose.
This was way back at the end of 45, yes.
So later?
Yeah, it was about September 45, yes, when we actually set sail. And I remember coming out of Rosyth docks in a thick fog. And you couldn't see more than 20 feet in front of the ship. It was very, very thick. And we had the radar on, which gave us the line of the fourth bridge, which we had to get under. And it took us over an hour to get under the bridge because we had all the ship's company available around the forecastle, yelling out whenever they could see the bridge appearing. And we kept having to go astern because we were going to hit one of the stanchions of the bridge. And we did that three or four times, and eventually we found ourselves in no man's land, as it were, and somebody yelled out, there was a noise overhead, and somebody yelled out, "Train overhead, sir." And we knew we were far enough through the bridge to carry on. And we made it eventually, and about 2 hours later we got out in the North Sea and the fog cleared a little bit, and we made good speed right the way down the North Sea. And it took us a couple of days, I think, to come right round, and we pulled in at Plymouth, where we took on as many stores as we could. I stayed there for a few days, and then we set sail for Philadelphia. And to the best of my recollection, there were four of the flotilla going back at that time. And I remember Mr. Begg arranging that we'd only navigate one day in four, as it were. They'd take it in turns to navigate, and the other ships would follow next ahead. It seemed a sensible idea. Unfortunately, I
ought to ask, you had a new captain at this time, Lieutenant Commander Gutterly. When did he arrive?
Well, he arrived certainly, I would say, within a month after D-Day.
So drop him in. What was he like?
I got on very well with him. He was the original captain. Lieutenant Brownrigg was R&R, and he very seldom saw him smile. And the second captain, Mr. Goatley, I believe was a solicitor in, somewhere in East Anglia, and he was R&R, and he had a much more civilian's outlook on the Navy, and had a very good sense of humour. And if anyone did something stupid, he'd enroll them in his League of Copper Bottom Bums, as he used to call them. And I was enrolled one day when we were out on patrol, and it was pouring the rain on us, and I put down the cover on the voice pipe because it was raining, shooting as buckets of rain going down the voice pipe into the wheelhouse. And of course he turned round just after I'd done it and gave an order, and the top of the voice pipe was shut. So I said, sorry, sir, it was raining down there, so I thought I'd close it. So I was duly enrolled in the League of Cock Bottom Buns, so I didn't do that again. And he had a good sense of humour, but he was very, very efficient. As I think I mentioned, he never left the brig in action.
What had happened to the old captain?
Cause he got made up from lieutenant to lieutenant commander. And where he went from there, I don't know.
But nothing untoward had happened?
No, nothing. It was a very smooth transition from one captain to another. I imagine that, I don't know what happened to Mr. Brown, it would be interesting to know. I should think he would make a very good officer as a subordinate officer on a bigger ship. But he didn't seem to have the confidence to really, be a very efficient captain on a small ship. It'd be interesting to know what did happen to him.
Now, what about the next thing in the voyage is a big storm that arose. What do you remember of that?
Oh, yes. Well, we took on stores for our big trip. I think it was, I don't know how many days it was planned for, I'm sure. But within 2 days, we'd run under this terrible storm in mid-Atlantic. And we never saw the other three ships again until they all arrived one day or another in Philadelphia with us.
Now, what was the storm like?
Well, it was horrific. It was horrific. I was one of four chaps who were detailed to take the wheel. We were doing 4 hours on, and we were doing four on, four off. It might have been four or eight off, I don't know, but it probably was. There were enough ratings on board, I think, to do four on the wheel and then 8 hours off. But the storm was such that, well, I've never seen a poor old ship get in such rough water. You'd, you stand on the looking out from the wheelhouse, and you'd see a huge wave, 50, 60 feet wave, and you just sort of plow into it, and the whole ship would be covered with water. And you'd come up the other side, and the next thing you knew, there was another one there. And the ship was just being tossed around like a cork, pushed aside. It was very, very difficult to hold the course. And I recall twice the officer would watch you hold down, try and hold your course, and I'd been thrown off the wheel, and I was sort of scrabbling around on the deck of the wheelhouse trying to get back on the wheel. It was really horrific. And it went on and on and on. I don't know how many days. It just seemed like a nightmare to me. I was sort of crawling down off of the watch, and we had to swing our hammocks at that time. You couldn't sleep in the bunks, they were just getting tossed. You'd have to lash yourself in a bunk to stay there, but the hammocks were reasonable. You swung those, and you could get some rest in a hammock. It swung with the motion of the ship, and you could get reasonably comfortable in. But I can recall that the poor old ship was getting dashed about so violently that one day I got beat on the head. I was just stepping off the bottom of a ladder when the ship went down violently, and the deckhead came down. It dropped so quickly that the deckhead came down and hit me on the head. And I dropped about 4 feet to the deck when it hit me. And took me some time afterwards to get my senses back. But it really was. I never believed that the ship could survive in such a heavy sea.
Were you worried it might sink?
Yeah, I was. I was looking at this when I came off watch. I used to walk through the ERA's workshop, and this swinger meter was just being, it was like a pendulum of a big clock going bang bang against the side of the ship's run. And it was just horrific, and it seemed to go on forever. I remember I couldn't eat anything. All the time I was doing that duty on the ship's wheel, the only thing I had was little sips of rum, and I chewed on dry biscuits. That was all I could take, couldn't eat any meals. And that went on for some days, just sips of rum, and feeling horrible. And we had a bucket tied to the binnacle. If you did feel sick when you were on watch, you could just retch into the bucket and carry on. But I can recall the utter joy of waking up one morning from my hammock and finding the ship was no longer being tossed around, and we'd come out of a storm. And everything was calm and peaceful. I got up, had a wash, and put the kit on, and went on the upper deck, and you could see the coast of America ahead. And it was a wonderful feeling come through that storm. There were several times where I thought we weren't going to make it, but we did. And we got to the other ships, of course. The radar was useless. The radar was just showing snow. And the other ships, I think we were the second to arrive. Somebody had got there first. And the others turned up within several days. But I know we were at least 3 days adrift from our ETA, the estimated time of arrival, getting there because of this tremendous storm we went through. But we got there, and it was wonderful.
Did you get any sort of reception?
Yes, as soon as we got into the mouth of the Delaware River, we sprung our paying off pennant, which was a huge thing, about 80 foot long, streaming from large little thin banner. And we streamed our paying off pennant, and of course all the ships in the river sounded their sirens and went up. And it's quite a long way. It took us pretty well all day, I think, to go up the Delaware into the actual city of Philadelphia. And we tied up at the naval dockyard there. And then we had probably 2 or 3 weeks actually tied up there, and that was rather wonderful because the local people made us very welcome.
In what way?
I got invited to somebody's house for a tea. And everyone was friendly and waved, and one of the things I remember was the food. We've been used to wartime food and the national loaf and everything else in Britain. Although the food on board ship was ample enough. But the first thing I did was I went into a little cafe in Philadelphia and bought a huge slice of lemon meringue pie. And I can still remember that. It took me about half an hour to eat it. It was a huge great piece of lemon meringue pie. It was beautiful. And glasses of cold milk as well. I can remember that. You could buy ice cold milk, and it was quite incredible. I can remember going into a pub and playing darts with a few Americans.
And that was for about 3 weeks?
That was for 2 or 3 weeks, yes. And then we had, the owner came aboard, we were told that we were going to leave the ship, which was rather sad in a way, after it had been our home for all that time. But we were bused to the railway station. Before we did, the canteen petty officer, canteen manager, opened the canteen and said, "Help yourself." So we loaded up our kit bags with all sorts of chocolate goodies and things and cigarettes. Everybody, we shared out the contents of the canteen between the ship's company. And then we were bused to the station, and we went back to Saker, strangely enough, but we were only there a few days when we were on the back of a lorry again and taken down to New York docks, and we boarded the Queen Mary, much to our delight. And they were taking troops and things back, but it was mainly just a handful. There weren't a lot of people on board it at all, and we virtually had the run of the ship. It just took about 5 days home. But even the Queen Mary was affected by the weather. We ran into the tail end of another storm coming back to Southampton. And I can remember it was a very strange experience to be able to walk up and down the huge stairways on the Queen Mary. And as the ship went down in the tropical waves, it would be very easy. You'd sort of walk up 10 or 12 stairs with no effort at all, and then the ship would start coming up, and you'd have a great difficulty in walking 3 or 4 steps because the ship was being pressured up against your feet. So that was quite fun. But then we got to Southampton after about 5 days, tied up to a buoy, and they sent a big tug over to take the VIP passengers ashore. And the following day, we were taken ashore back to Southampton, put on a train, and back we came to Chatham, where I think we had some leave. We had about a week's leave from Chatham. And then when I got back to Chatham, we were immediately sent up to Harwich again, back to our old stamping ground. And we were part of a crew on three, they were frigates, I believe, tied up in the middle of Harwich Harbour, the Ribble, the Tay, and the three frigates anyway. I'll perhaps remember it later on. And they were sort of a base camp for all the submarine S-boats, all the British submarines, starting with S, Stygian, Sturgeon, Seawall, Sea Rover. They were all tied up there. 20 or 30 submarines all tied up, and they had just skeleton crews on board, and we had to, we were just sort of there as spare numbers.
Now, when did you start that? You've gone, according to your letter, you've got the voyage to America had been in October 45.
Yeah.
You'd been back about November, with your leave. Would that be when you started at Harwich? Or?
I suppose it was. I don't know. Time was a bit vague after all these years.
Of course.
But, it must have been 3 weeks from. I think I'm right in saying that I had my 21st birthday on our stormy trip across the Atlantic, and that was on October the 10th. So it was probably a month later before we. More than a month, 6 or 7 weeks later.
So say December.
It was probably December when we came back on the Queen Mary, yeah.
And what were you doing in Harwich on this? You were on the depot ship.
Well, I was sleeping at the depot ships. And, we were just crew there. And we didn't have a lot of work to do. They did the occasional cleaning ship routine. But really, we were just sort of looking after ourselves. Fortunately, we had a good chef in our mess. And he kept us well fed. And we just took the chaps to and from these submarines. I had the opportunity of going over one of them. They were very awkward things to get onto. You had to run the boat alongside and take a deep breath and leap from the boat onto the tank of the flotation tank of the submarine. And it was quite a tricky do to get on from the submarine into a boat and vice versa. But I remember some of the crew of the submarine and thinking, they were a bit mad. But you could understand it after all they've been through. But and we were there right up until I was immobilised in June 46.
And what do you remember of your demobilisation?
Well, that took place on a big depot ship in Harwich Harbour. I believe it was called the Cooling Sound. Big depot ship there, and we just went on board there for a day and had a sort of medical, and that was it. We were demobbed. I think they gave us a demob suit there on board ship as well, and that was it. Within a couple of weeks, we departed. And
were you sorry to?
Well, you do. I mean, you think all the chaps you've got to know, the ship's company and everything else, and you wonder whether you'll see them again. But also, of course, you're looking forward to seeing your family again, your mother and father and everything else, because they had a rough time. The mother endured the bombing throughout the war. And there we were, so it was homeward bound.
Now, what were you to do? You'd worked at Waterlows.
I worked at Waterlows, and I went back to working at Waterlows. Yeah.
Did you ever consider doing anything different? I mean, you'd had a lot of experience in other jobs, but...
No, for some reason I didn't. I don't know. One always sort of looked at that was your life. That was going to be your life. So I went back to work for Waterloo and finished my apprenticeship. And that was it.
Did you have any problems settling back into civilian life after all your experiences?
It took me 3 or 4 weeks to get back into the world of print. Yes. Yes, it did. Everything seems so strange, you know, and to be living at home seems strange as well at first.
Any particular problems, either physical or mental, or advantages from your service, do you think?
No, it was quite hard work because life in those days was quite long. You know, we used to have to invariably start work at 6 in the morning and do 2 hours overtime. Because we used to do a lot of city work, and people expected their report and accounts and memorandum of an associate and arts association. They expect them on their desk by about 9 a.m. and we had to get them printed and delivered before 9 a.m. So there was quite a lot of starting work at 6 in the morning. So you'd have to get up at 5 to get a work at 6. And you'd be working right through till 6 at night. And that went on for some time until, at long, long last, the union got a bit of clout behind them and the working week was reduced. And soon after that, by 1948 or 49, I was on shift work. I started shift work, which meant that I was working either mornings, so I used to do a week mornings and a week late shift. You work from, at first it was 6 till 2 and 2 to 10. But eventually that was whittled down from 6 to 1:30 and 1:30 to 9. And I found that quite convenient because it always meant that you had a bit of daylight to yourself. And in those days I used to play a lot of tennis. And I'd come home and you know, you'd spend an afternoon playing tennis. I had the energy to do it in those days. But it was quite nice.
So your wartime experience had no real bad effects? Any good effects?
Not really. No, just grateful that I come through it. Just grateful that I come through it, really.
Now, what about, you're a member of the Captain's Class Association. What other associations had you been a member of? And had you sort of, did you keep up your Navy links before you joined?
I didn't. I had one friend that I used to play tennis with. He was a supply rating on board the Ribble, which was our little ship in Harwich Harbour. We were looking after the submarines. And I still know him. Yeah.
So what made you join the Captain Class Frigate Association? Because you are a member.
Well, a friend of mine recommended another book to me about the fighting captain, Captain Walker, who was one of the ace submarine killers on a destroyer during the war, and I sent off on his, he gave me the book number, and I sent off to Pennant Hill Books for the book, and having done that, I got put on their mailing list, and a few months later they sent me another mailing list which had Donald Collingwood's book on it, The Captain Class Frigates, and through Donald Collingwood I found out that there was indeed an old boys association, so I went to the reunion, only to find that there was only one other member of our ship there, and he turned out to be a drunken Scotsman. So, there we are. That's brought you up to date pretty well.
Thank you very much.